thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 44 for the 29th of September, 2009. Unsettled. I'm Dan Cohen. And welcome back to a new edition of the Digital Campus podcast. I'm Dan Cohen, and here with our regulars, Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, Dan.
And Tom Scheinfeld. Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys.
Hey, we're piping in Tom NPR style from an undisclosed location. And so we're glad we could get you on, Tom, even via cell phone. And we're really glad to have a couple of new, I guess what we're calling semi-regulars. That sounds like half-calf, decaf or something at Starbucks where you are, Tom. But we're advancing the podcast in new ways. And one of the ways in which we're doing it is simply because Tom, Mills, and I are just sick of each other's voices, right? And
pretty much, yeah.
And we agree with each other too much. We need to diversify the podcast, and so we're delighted to add two new podcasters to the Digital Campus team this week, and we'll be adding more in weeks to come and rotating the team. And so the first one that we'd like to introduce is Amanda French, who is in New York City right now. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Dan.
Good to talk to you. Good to have you on the podcast. Thanks for being willing to do this.
Oh my gosh, willing doesn't even cover it. Try eager.
You're too kind. It's great to have you on. We have a lot to say about Amanda. She's a friend of the show and is a, how should we introduce you? As a research scholar at NYU.
My title is always a little dicey, but assistant research scholar.
We'll drop the assistant.
Okay.
Can we call you a senior research scholar at NYU? Where she's helping to model a digital curriculum for the MA program in Archives and Public History. She's actually teaching a class right now on digital history, and we can talk about that. You can check out her program at aphdigital.org, and a project that's sort of coming along to come up with certainly a better digital history curriculum than I probably have at the current moment, which is at digitalhistorycurriculum.org. And Amanda can be found at amandafrench.net and, of course, on the Twitter at Amanda French. Welcome to the podcast, Amanda.
Thank you so much.
We're also joined from the University of Mary Washington, just south of here, by Jeff McClurkin. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Jeff is a associate professor and chair of History and American Studies at the University of Mary Washington. And your independent research is really in 19th century America, is that right?
That's correct,
okay.
Yeah.
As well as digital humanities and some of the things that we tend to talk about on the podcast. And he can be found at Techist, is your kind of digital humanities blog, is that right?
That's correct. The easiest way to find me is McClurkin.org.
Okay,
and
great.
All my links are from there. So.
And Jay McClurkin on Twitter. So,
that's correct.
Welcome to you all. It's great to have you on the podcast. And, well, why don't we kick right in? Although we've kind of been an all Google all the time podcast, I suppose we need to once again revisit Google Books because there were some serious developments this week. Really from after receiving the firestorm of criticism that we discussed on the last podcast, the authors who are on the plaintiff side of the podcast asked the court, and Google did not object, for an extension, a several-month extension, to, I guess, modify the settlement. Where are we? Has anyone been following this in enough detail to understand? I've seen some posts saying that the settlement is dead, but isn't it more like it's going back for modifications and will be represented to the court?
Well, as I understand it, that's part of the question is whether or not they're going to, quote unquote, tweak it or sort of really throw it away. But it's a hard case to follow. I always have the sense that there are a number of very specific legal points that they're really talking about that don't necessarily have or are not necessarily directly relevant to what I'm concerned about and what a lot of people are concerned about, which is I don't want Google to have an exclusive monopoly over the orphan works. So
that seems to be one of the big issues, isn't it? That came up is everyone kind of understands the state of the public domain books, and more or less we understand books where the authors are still around or the publishers who have copyright really know what they're doing and have either opted in or opted out. But there is this key segment of 1.5 or 2 million books, I still haven't gotten a definitive number, that are sort of in limbo, and that this settlement would effectively give through this book rights registry to Google for whatever purposes it sees fit, at least as the critics put it.
That's right. I think that the crux of all of this and the reason sort of behind the settlement and the money that's being paid as part of the settlement, the $125 million, goes to this book rights registry, which deals with this problem of the orphan works. It is complicated, though. There are a lot of other concerns that have been raised, including privacy concerns by the EFF and others. The Department of Justice weighed in this week, saying essentially that this probably should go forward. The parties, have some rough agreement on how they should proceed. But there are enough concerns that the settlement should be revised, and I think the judge, Judge Chin, took that into account this week and sent the parties back for further negotiations. I'm not at all surprised that that's how it turned out. I think probably the Obama administration and the judge, and I sort of agree with this, that there is a settlement here that can work, that doesn't give Google a monopoly, that doesn't violate privacy rights, that doesn't make sweeping changes to copyright law by judicial fiat, that there is a settlement here that can work, but that maybe the way this one is currently written, it's not quite there yet. And so I think it's probably just going to go back for a couple months and come back. And my guess would be we're going to see something that we're all going to be a little happier with when that happens.
I mean, isn't the likely outcome, right, that they'll have to grant other parties some kind of license to these orphan works or somehow make sure that piece isn't a monopoly? I mean, the privacy concerns is odd because, you're on the web. I mean, you're doing Google searches. Those are also, if you search for things, those are being stored, and those tell you a lot about a person just as much as checking out a book, maybe more so.
Yeah, I sort of, this is sort of opportunistic. They're just getting in these concerns about privacy because Google is before a judge. I think people have concerns about privacy in Google just generally, and they happen to be before a judge right now, and so they're kind of slipping those in into this to kind of push Google in a certain direction more broadly. But yeah, as part of this particular issue, it doesn't seem like the crux of the matter.
Have they addressed at all the pricing issue? Because that seemed like another sticking point that we discussed last week on the podcast. I think, Mills, you made the great point that however benevolent the current leaders of Google are, one can imagine in 20 years that a more profit-driven company would, put the screws on local libraries with this terminal that has still not been really priced out or, pricing to libraries like ours here at Mason, how we would get access to the broad collection, since it's not, those prices aren't spelled out in the settlement.
I don't see anything in the settlement or any of the news stories about it that even brings that up. And this is in a way similar to Amanda's concern about the orphan works, because, I remain worried that it's going to end up being sort of like JSTOR, that the institutions and organizations that can afford the access will have that access, and the institutions and organizations that can't won't. And so will public libraries, especially in rural areas where they have no money, will they be able to have this kind of access? And so then do we start creating, some sort of privileged information and unprivileged information? It's just potentially a real problem that I think, given the global nature of this, it really needs to be addressed.
And if I could add to that, I think for academic libraries in particular, they've been so burned by what has been happening for the last, 20, 30 years with journal subscription prices going way, way, way up. And, it just feels like some of the publishers have libraries in a stranglehold and can raise the prices to whatever they want, because these academic libraries have to have those journal subscriptions for better adding to their store of knowledge that the faculty use. So I think libraries have learned from that and are saying we desperately don't want to get into that situation with Google, where Google is in a position to dictate the price to us. So I don't know whether, however, that I'm sure that is a concern that they're discussing among themselves. I don't know whether the judge in this particular delay of the agreement cited that as an issue.
Well, I mean, what I thought was interesting about this was that the Justice Department weighed in such a way to say that the settlement itself would have actually changed copyright law, or would have set a precedent for copyright law. And I think that's, you know, it seems to me that they're thinking that this is an important, it's such a huge case and such a right. such a huge number of books involved that this is a real, potentially a real precedent setter for some of the questions that Amanda was just raising about you know, journal subscriptions and about, you know, all this information that's increasingly behind these subscription walls that makes it harder for lots of, you know, I mean, my university has problems, you know, affording to buy all of these, you know, all of these journals. And if we have to, you know, subscribe to Google Books as well, I mean, I think it raises some real questions.
And in fact, actually, I'll be a little pro Google for just a moment. On the one hand, you know, they did do the work. They did do the scanning. And they did it when few people in the academic and nonprofit sector was willing to. So I actually do think that most of the people I talk to about Google Book Search do agree that Google has a little bit of a right to profit somewhat from this. But, and everybody also wants this digital library to exist. I actually gave a paper a little while ago about the enormous benefit that Google Book Search had for my research. I did my dissertation research in 2004 before Google Book Search, revisited it after Google Book Search, and it was phenomenal, like the kinds of things that I could find using this resource that I couldn't have otherwise. So, but I think that the fact that this has been delayed is a really good thing, and I think, as you say, Dan, we're going to be happier with this unsettled settlement when they renegotiate it.
Right. I mean, Amanda, you bring up the great point that you know, academics are really good at looking a gift horse in the mouth. It's one of the things we specialize in. And, I respect Google for doing this. I mean, Microsoft, after all, had a scanning project and they stopped. And, you know, I know lots of people at Yale, literally, they just one day pulled up and left. And, you know, they were nice enough to leave their scanning equipment there and their files there. But they didn't have the commitment that you know, Google had to do this and to spend the $300 million. So I think at least we need to keep on the table that, and I'm dreading this because I'm on a panel called Is Google Good for History at the American Historical Association meeting. I think I've been put on it as the patsy. I'm really concerned about going up there. But I'm sort of going to be the guy who sits between the angry person who's opposed to Google and the guy from Google. So that will be fun. But, you know, I mean, my point is I can see some, you know, tremendous benefits to this. It seems to me like there will be a settlement. We've come too far. There's been too many books scanned. And, you know, I guess the question is, it really boils down to how much we trust Google, right? I mean, isn't there a kind of larger issue here? We've talked about a lot on the podcast. For instance, with email outsourcing, we had this case this past week where some Brown University students were able to read each other's Gmail email because of a mess up with the Brown Google Apps for your domain site. And there's just sort of lots of little cases as we go along where people both love Google because it provides free, incredible things, and hate them because of potential monopoly power. And it just kind of boils down to that, doesn't it?
No, I disagree. I don't think it does boil down to whether we trust Google, because the truth is that I do trust Google. And I trust Gmail. I mean, Gmail's outages and mix-ups, I think, are no worse than you would get from something that's internal. They just get a lot more news play and potentially affect a lot more people. But with the settlement, even though I trust Google, I don't want there to be it to be inscribed in the law or in case law precedent that Google has all this power. I do really trust them, but I want to make sure that that's not the only recourse I have.
Right. I think the issue here is we you know, we can trust Google, but I also want a choice not to use Google if I, you know, if that choice presents itself. And I think as the settlement was currently written, effectively, these orphan works would be under the scans of these orphan works would be under Google's control. And if a smaller project even wanted to come along and do a scanning project of some subset of the orphan works in the world, of a particular author or of a particular publisher or whatever, it would make it very difficult for them to negotiate the rights to those books. That's I think the problem with
That's a real key part of this is the book rights registry itself, isn't it? That's hard to replicate. Anyone can scan the books. It's getting that piece of it.
Well, and we desperately need that, you know. We need to have that registry. That part I always have found a little weird that, I mean, Google has the technical chops to build it. So everybody's happy about that. But it seems like a kind of registry that should be, you know, something similar to, you know, something owned by, and run by the Copyright Office.
Right, exactly. And I just think we just need to maintain choice in this arena and opportunity. And as long as that's there, I'm happy to use Google as long as Google's the best thing out there, and currently it is.
Right, and as long as we're setting precedents that we do think about, you know, life beyond Google, right? That, you know, if others do want to come along, that the potential for creating some better set of these works is there. We should it should be able to happen. Locking us in is what concerns me most.
Yeah, I mean, but hasn't the underlying assumption in all the coverage of this is that no one else is ever going to do this? Am I wrong about that? That Google is the only one who will ever actually make a project to scan tens of millions of books or 20 million books, whatever the final number is.
Well, I think that's an assumption, but I think also it's worth remembering what happens to companies in the United States when they develop too much of a stranglehold on a particular market. You know, Standard Oil got broken up, AT&T got broken up. If Google, you know, controls all text, then they'll get broken up. I think, you know, I just expect that will happen eventually if they exert too much of a stranglehold on the information market.
And I'm also just not willing, and I said this last time we got together, I'm just not willing to concede that Google is the only entity on the planet that can do this.
Right.
You know, it's a $300 million project. That's a big project, but companies and governments and even non-governmental organizations undertake $300 million projects all the time. So, it's for something this important. It's not all that expensive, and I'm just not willing to concede that Google's the only game in town.
Really, since those books still
exist. For now,
maybe. You know, those books are still on the shelves of those libraries. You know, they, to their credit, Google didn't destroy them in the process of scanning them.
Just so long as that very large subset of those books on the shelves, those orphan works, are available to another party, if that party decides they want to scan them. So.
Right.
That's, I think, the key. And I think it's sort of unclear in the settlement what if Microsoft or if some other company or the European Union or whoever came along and said, okay, we want to scan all these orphan works too, whether they would ever be able to come to a similar settlement as the one Google has come to. That I think, is the crux of this. And I think as long as there's opportunity for someone else to come along and do that, then we're fine. I'd be satisfied.
What did others make about the acquisition of ReCAPTCHA this past week? It was kind of a sidebar to the main story about the Google Book settlement being postponed. But in some ways, it is a big part of the story, right? I mean, ReCAPTCHA is this technology that Louis von Ahn, a really brilliant MacArthur Genius Grant winning computer scientist at Carnegie Mellon, and his team came up with for effectively transcribing books in a really shrewd way by using words from difficult-to-read books as little puzzles that human beings would have to solve to, for instance, sign up for an account or add a blog post. And so you'll see on a lot of sites kind of wavy, squished-up words and that come out of books that are being scanned as part of the Google Books project and other projects. Internet Archive actually was part of the ReCAPTCHA system as well. And by solving those words, transcribing them by hand, you are effectively digitizing these books. So Google went ahead. I mean, this is a project that many consider to be kind of nonprofit, a research project at Carnegie Mellon, and they've acquired it, surely in part, to make their Google Book search better.
I mean, they had already been using this to some extent, as I understood it. It wasn't completely in-house, but they were already using that technology for some of the Google Books and their some of their archival newspaper stuff. So, I mean, in some ways, it's not a big change for them. The question is why they chose to bring it in-house as opposed to, you know, is that about keeping it from others? If you wanted to take a particularly Google is evil perspective on this, that's, you know, this is about making sure that other people won't be able to do other book projects. I have no information along those lines, but it certainly could be interpreted that way. I mean, why, if they were already using it, did they need to bring it in-house?
Well, the other issue I have with this a little bit is this is all very clever. You're killing two birds with one stone. You know, it's a little security thing, and then you're also improving OCR, and I suppose improving the texts. But what many people want, particularly librarians, with regard to Google Books, is a way to correct the metadata. You know, to correct the scanned, you know, the OCR text of those things, and also the metadata about them. They want to be able to send that information directly to Google. And so far, Google Books does not allow that. So this is a very indirect and, maybe overly clever way of improving those texts. Why can't we just improve them directly?
You know, at Digital Humanities 2009, the meeting at the University of Maryland, John Orwant of the Google Books Project, that question was posed to him about why they wouldn't take more human input. And I think the difference between reCAPTCHA and a direct, you know, feedback mechanism is, I mean, I'm paraphrasing John here, and I hope not doing him disservice, but they sort of distrust crowdsourcing. Mm. And I think what's interesting about reCAPTCHA is it has this engineering view of crowdsourcing where multiple people have to solve the same word before it's considered solved. You know, it doesn't have that direct input as you would have in, let's say, a wiki where anyone could kind of come in. Although, of course, this past week, Google launched this side wiki project where anyone could come in and annotate a website and store that information on Google. So, I don't know. There's a little bit of maybe schizophrenia here.
And you can imagine this being applied not just to the text, to the body text of these of Google Books. You can imagine it being applied to the metadata as well. You know, if they wanted to use it on certain segments of title pages, for instance, you could have people transcribing publication dates and publication locations and ISBN numbers and other things. So you could imagine it being something. They'd have to make it a little bit more sophisticated, but something that could be used for metadata as well. I mean, I have this kind of gut distrust of, you know, this thing. I use reCAPTCHA on my blog. I thought it was this kind of open sourcey, kind of independent, scholarly side project, and, you know, then it gets sold to Google for an undisclosed amount, and it just kind of rubs me the wrong way, but I don't really have any reason that it should rub me the wrong way. I guess the reason it rubs me the wrong way is it just seems like, and here we are, you know, halfway through our podcast, still talking about Google, like Google's and now they're taking over academic software projects. And, you know, if somebody came along and offered us, you know, $50 million for Omeka or Zotero, would we sell out? I mean, we kind of can't, but you know, it's a little disheartening, I guess. So
right.
That's sort of my feeling on it.
Okay, we'll try to move beyond Google here, Tom. I hear you. I was going to bring up that on the positive side of Google's chutzpah, they have decided they're going to take over Internet Explorer by inserting Chrome in it. But maybe we'll discuss that next time. I think it's an interesting
development. I think I would choose Google over Internet Explorer.
Yes.
Agreed.
Okay.
Well, that's the problem. The benevolent dictator is still a dictator.
Yeah. Yep. Gosh. All right. We'll bring up Aristotle. Will be on the next podcast. We'll be reading Aristotle's Politics. Book one, next time on Digital Campus. Well, speaking of benevolent dictators, Windows 7, are we excited? Are we having parties?
Fired up,
ready to go? Have they bought a Rolling Stones song yet for it? Is there anything that we can say about Windows 7 for the academic market? I mean, actually, to their credit, $30 upgrade for students in the United States.
That's a good thing, too. Publicize if people don't know that there are discounted versions of Windows 7, not versions, but installations of Windows 7 for students.
Well, I hope it works better than the upgrades to Word, for instance, in the new versions of Microsoft Office.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big question will be, I mean, if you sort of delve down a little deeper, they basically are telling people, if you have Vista, this upgrade will work. But if you don't, if you have some earlier version, that you should probably think about getting a new computer. That's pretty much what they say. So it does sound like it's kind of it's a limited upgrade. It's an upgrade that mostly that they really intend for Vista-enabled machines. But I do know that there are a number of campuses that are still using XP. They haven't switched over to Vista yet, and so Microsoft is clearly attempting to, you know, by getting students to switch over, I think trying to convince, institutional IT groups to make that switch as well. I think that's been
and then in 3 or 4 years when those students graduate, they're going to expect the new version of Windows on their work computer as well. So students are a good place to start to kind of see the market. I totally agree, Joe.
Are there any features of Windows 7 that I'm unaware of that I should be excited about that have any kind of impact, or is this just...
Well, I run desktop Linux, Ubuntu, but I have been running the Windows 7 release candidate in VirtualBox for a few months now, occasionally if I want to like use Microsoft Word to make sure the formatting on a document is right or something, I keep a Windows instance available. And, you know, I will say, and I will go out on a limb here, I will say that Windows 7 is great. It's not just good, it's great. And it is, you know, it's still Windows. So, you know, that is what it is. But it delivers as, I would say, as polished an experience as Mac OS X does. It's really great looking. I've experienced almost no crashes, which for Windows is saying something. You know, I think, you know, old software from XP and Vista seems to work just fine. It works very well with my hardware. You know, I think this is a real winner for Microsoft. The question will be whether they can kind of get their reputation back. They can rebuild their image with this or not. But in terms of just the technology, I think, you know, we're looking at definitely the best Windows, certainly since XP, and I would say probably since Windows 98. So, you know, I think, no, I mean, there's no features. You know, it's not going to, you know, do your homework for you or anything, but
I think students would adopt it really quickly.
You know, but it is as slick and nice an operating system as you're going to find, and I would include, you know, the new Snow Leopard in that category. So I think
so. It keeps Windows alive as something that's important, that would be important to campuses or library terminals or things like that for another few years.
Oh, Windows is very much alive, right. I think, you know, there's...
Well, on this podcast, we're always like looking beyond that somehow everything's going to move to the cloud or something like this and that the operating system doesn't matter. This seems to say to me, well, you know, a nice, slick, good operating system for Microsoft still matters.
Yeah, I think you can't count them out. I think it's too easy. And frankly, historically speaking, this is their pattern, right? I mean, you have 98, and then you had me, and then you had XP, and then you have Vista. And then, I mean, you sort of, you know, you have a good operating system that everybody uses, and then they try something else, and it doesn't really work, and then they go to a good operating system that everybody uses. So we're back to this is their time. Windows 7 is the good one. So
if I can, I just ask a. Tom, a question. How's the search, the hard drive search? Have you tried that?
The search, I would say, is much improved. I would say from you know, what I tend not to use the operating search all that much, but I would say it's, from my experience, it's as good as the Spotlight search on the Mac. And it's actually it's kind of more conveniently located than the Spotlight search on the Mac. It's sort of it's built into the Start menu, which is kind of where everything is on Windows, and it's sort of right there when you click on that Start button. Really, your cursor is placed in the search box, and so the search I think works really pretty well. Things seem quickly indexed. And in terms of the browsing experience, they do some really nice things with stacking icons. So for browsing photo galleries or something, where visual materials, they're stacked in interesting ways, and you can resort them according to color or according to date or according to the device that they were taken on. So there's different ways to kind of browse these stacks of images. So, that kind of... information management interface is really good. I have very good things to say at Windows 7.
Well, Tom, I'm looking forward to your Windows 7 release party in 3 weeks.
Oh yeah, you're all invited.
Thank you very much. That sounds
perfect. Sure, it'll be in my office. I'm not expecting very many. I have 3 chairs in my office, so I think I'll do it.
Several other Windows 7 launch parties to go to that same night, so I won't be able to come.
Oh well.
Too popular for the rest of us, Amanda.
Well, I guess so. We don't want you at our Windows 7 party.
Well, this will be a bad segue, but from the Windows 7 parties, it seems like the parties are over in university libraries, according to a meeting in New York at Baruch College about the libraries of the future, which, according to an article at Inside Higher Ed and some of the Twitter traffic that we saw about the conference, this conference on the sustainability of libraries in a digital age really focused on sparse staffing in the future, highly decentralized libraries where all their information is sort of outsourced to the cloud, and a smaller physical plant just focusing on special collections. Amanda, you kind of followed this conference. Was it as depressing as it sounds in this article, or were there good things to come out of it? I know a lot of librarians were worried about what this implied about their future.
Well, it's interesting. This idea that the library will cease to be primarily a noble building filled with books has certainly been kicking around for quite a while, and there's no reason it needs to be a scenario of doom, actually. If you define library as your sort of information acquisition and dissemination nexus for the library, or in the case of public libraries, for your county or whatnot, your area. If you define a library that way, then I think everybody agrees that libraries are not going away. But it is funny how this particular meeting, where Daniel Greenstein said, we're going to see the physical building of the library house only special collections and study areas. The actual information dissemination part of the library will, as you say, reside in the cloud. Perhaps not surprising, but it is a little surprising how freaked out people get by that, because there's a utopian vision of that same thing, right? If you start from scratch, if you were to design a 21st century library from scratch, many people say, well, this is kind of what it would look like. So I found this meeting really interesting in that, in one way, it's a horrible vision, but in another way, it's a very utopian vision. There are real benefits to having all that information in the cloud. In many cases, there's no real reason to have a big noble building filled with books and journals and so on. But I think that actually, the physical space of the library is probably not going away anytime soon, if only because I've read elsewhere that need for study space is actually going up and up and up. As students learn to collaborate more online, they learn to collaborate more in person as well. And so particularly at universities, they find the library invaluable as a place to study with their Wi-Fi enabled laptop open on the table in front of them, rather than, with the books from the stacks spread out in front of them.
Well, and, along those lines, I spend a fair amount of time in my local public library, and it's full of people using the computers. And I think probably most of those people did not drive up in their BMWs and Mercedes. There are an awful lot of people in our communities who really need this kind of information access. And the library is the one place that they can get it, whether it is the only place that they can actually use email, or the place where they can, go online and look for further information, whether it's about a book or a property tax issue that they're having or something like that. So the library also is this kind of community information space, I think, is not going to go away anytime soon. I was struck, though, when I read this article in Inside Higher Ed that about the meeting, that if it turns out the way that Greenstein says, it's time to sell your stock in university presses, because the only thing that's keeping university presses open is the library orders. And because if it weren't for those library orders, the number of books that they would sell would drop into the dozens instead of instead of the thousands or hundreds. And so, you know, that would be the final death blow to the university presses. But if they're not dead already, this would for sure kill them off. But, you know, a number of years ago, I taught at Grinnell College, and the library there is quite a nice library. I mean, Grinnell has tons of money that they can spend on pretty much whatever they want. And the students joked about this addition that was on the library. They called it the Steve Jobs Wing. And the reason it was called the Steve Jobs Wing, according to like the local common knowledge, whether it's true or not, I'm not sure, but Jobs had been on the board of Grinnell when they were getting ready to build the new library. And he convinced the board that they shouldn't spend so much money on the structure because books were pretty much over. And so they wouldn't need all of that space for stacks. And so they built a library without enough stack space. And then they believed him because, of course, who doesn't believe Steve Jobs? And so they, he can be very persuasive, I'm told. Mm-hmm. So they built this building without sufficient stack space, and then 6 or 7 years later had to build an addition just to accommodate the books.
I think in a case of journal articles and things like that, I think it would be much more plausible if a library consisted of nothing but journals and journal articles. Then I think that this everywhere library would come a lot sooner and with a lot less anxiety. However, ebook as an object is still an extremely rare beast. You know, you don't see it around that much. There's only so many people who have Kindles or ebook readers. We really have not settled how or even if the book is ever going to transition to the digital realm. So as long as there are books, I think there will continue to be good physical spaces for libraries.
Yeah, I would also add to that I think that that I would echo Amanda's point about student space, because I do think that's, if you look at the new libraries that are being designed these days, there is a lot of attention paid to that. Johns Hopkins has been putting together a new library, and it has sort of, the books are not front and center. The study spaces are front and center. The collaborative spaces are front and center. So one thing I think is we do see more of that attention to, you know, collaborative spaces. The other thing that I would say is that even if Greenstein's vision, you know, comes true, that there is still a prominent space for the advice that librarians and research, you know, people to help out with research have in the process of being a library, right? I mean, if the library is sort of a knowledge center for the institution or for a community, librarians continue to have a role in helping people navigate through. Even if everything's online, even if everything's searchable through Google or something else, there's still a need for human assistance in directing us towards particular things. So,
well, there's a really great need for that, and what's often a shame is that neither students nor university administrations really recognize that. I mean, people feel like they can Google everything and find it, and they're not even aware that that's not true. And, you know, even still, too often, you know, the library training that a student gets consists of an hour in your composition class, and hey, you've been trained to use the library now, and it's a lot more complicated than it used to be. So, of course, librarians have this whole information literacy movement, and I'm glad that has taken.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be important for librarians. I think they're starting to do this, and I think people have written about this and studied this question, is how to connect to the students and the public in the ways that they are expecting them. How to get to students in ways that feel natural to the students. Like, I think sitting behind a reference desk probably isn't it. Figuring out ways to reach students in their, you know, on Facebook or whatever, however students want to communicate now, we're going to have to figure out a way to communicate with them that way. I was excited to see that the Mason Libraries now have a little Meebo widget, an instant message widget, where you can ask a librarian on the library, sort of the homepage. And so, you know, doing those kinds of things, experimenting with those kinds of technologies, is going to be an important piece here, because I still don't think that the building is even going to be the place where people go to ask a librarian a question.
Well, but I also think, I think that faculty have some responsibility in this as well, and ensuring that students don't just search in Google, and not just for our own sake, but I mean, I think, you know, you can make real efforts to bring librarians into your classroom, and we We do, you know, I do a session in our department's methods class where I bring the research librarian in, and so everybody sits there with their laptops and they're searching on their individual topics, and he's there, the research librarian is there sort of giving them advice about how to search different databases. And so, I mean, I think there are certainly ways that faculty have some responsibility in ensuring that that libraries and librarians don't get left out of this.
Well, it's exciting to go to Picks for the Week on the podcast. There's now even more picks with five of us. And actually, it might mean that a few of them are actually good, statistically speaking, because mine usually aren't. Amanda, maybe we'll start with you, in a hazing kind of way. Start with the new people. Do you have a site or a tool or something you want to point out to the audience that you think they might find useful?
I emphatically do. I was fortunate enough to be asked to read a forthcoming work by Kathleen Fitzpatrick, who is a scholar who's been doing work on scholarly publishing from a sort of a media studies point of view. She gave a great paper at Digital Humanities 2009, for instance. And so in conjunction with New York University Press and the Institute for the Future of the Book, she has just announced, or is just about to announce, in fact. We're recording this on Friday. She's going to announce this on Monday. So by the time you listen to this podcast, it will have been officially announced. Her book, Planned Obsolescence, Publishing Technology and the Future of the Academy. Now, this is published on futurethebook.org as part of Media Commons Press using Comment Press. So it is a site, really, but it is also a book. And it's just a marvelous book. I can't recommend it enough. I'm so enthusiastic about this book. I thought it was just really wonderful. So I can give you the URL for this, or of course you can put it in the...
Right. We'll go ahead and put it in the show notes, but that sounds terrific. I've been looking for that book to come out. Yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's mediacommons.futurethebook.org/mookpress/planned obsolescence. I won't rave any more about this book. I do recommend that you go and comment on it, because of course, as we know, Comment Press allows you to comment on each individual paragraph. I will just say that I'll give away the ending. The book recommends that universities take responsibility for scholarly publishing as a matter of infrastructure, that we basically not try to have university presses be these unsustainable cost recovery organizations that they are, that they really, the university itself, take responsibility for publishing the output of its own faculty, which would mean re-envisioning what a university press is in a major way.
Great. Thank you for that plug, and certainly look forward to reading that. Jeff McClurkin, what do you have for us this week on the podcast?
Sure. The site I'm recommending this week is TED.com, and that's, for those of you who don't know, the TED conference comes from Technology Entertainment Design. And this is a conference that's been going on for 25 years now. But in the last couple of years, they've begun to publish their TED Talks, as they're called, which are somewhere between 10 and 20-minute talks by leaders in a variety of fields, top thinkers. So Al Gore did the slideshow presentation there that became An Inconvenient Truth. And so I would recommend it's wonderful to see sort of the experts in a field try to take their life's work and condense it to 18 minutes. And two to sort of get you started are Ken Robinson's talk on how our schools are killing creativity, and pretty much anything Hans Rosling does. He's a professor who works with stats, especially statistics involving the comparisons between the third world and the first world, and very interesting stuff, fascinating stuff. And I highly recommend you check out TED. You will lose hours and hours of time, but you'll feel like you're doing work.
Right. Great. It's fun to kind of leaf through those, and we'll definitely link to those ones that you found most interesting for our audience. Thanks, Jeff.
Sure.
Mills, what do you have for us this time?
Well, in the sort of reversal of our bashing on Google today, I have a a somewhat humorous Google page. Humorous in one way. If you Google study tips for students and Google, you get this particular page which provides sort of links to various Google services for students. But it's lots of librarians and others point their students to these sort of information educators, point their students in the direction of this page because it shows them how to get to Google Books and how to use Google Scholar and things like that. But the part that I find rather humorous is that there's a nice little box in the upper right-hand corner that says, missing a great quote for your cover page or conclusion. And then you click generate a quote, and from somewhere in the Google database comes up a pithy quotation for the cover of your paper. And just as I looked at this today, the random quotation that came up on my screen was, historical books that contain no lies are extremely tedious. And this is from Anatole France. You refresh the page and you get another one. And so,
yeah, mine right now is, I have never let my schooling interfere with my education, Mark Twain.
Yeah.
Mine is H.G. Wells. His studies were pursued, but never effectually undertaken.
So I think we'll start seeing, if this gets wide dissemination among students, then we'll start seeing some really great quotations on the front pages of the papers our students give us.
Okay, thanks, Mills. Tom, do you have a pick for us this week?
What I'm going to recommend here is the Online Database of Social Media Policies. This is a database put together by a guy who's writing a book on social media governance. And essentially, it's a list of links to organizations, private companies, universities, non-governmental organizations, government organizations that are blogging or tweeting or on Facebook or MySpace. And it provides a link to those organizations, to their social media policies, the guidance that they give their employees and their members for how they should use social media. So if you are at a museum or a library or a university department or whatever institution, or if you're just trying to come up with a good policy for yourself, if you're trying to craft a social media policy and try to get a handle on how you should be using these things and what kind of recommendations you should give your staff or your colleagues for how they should be using these things, this is a good place to look for some models. There's about 99 today. The database contains 99. There's about 100 different policies here, and you can just surf through those to get an idea of what other organizations are doing in terms of managing this online communication that I think scares a lot of people, and in some ways should scare a lot of people. A lot of bad things, as well as a lot of good things, can happen in these social media spaces. And so I think it's important for organizations to start thinking about, at least if not a formal policy, an informal policy for how they and their colleagues and staff are going to use social media. And this is a good place to start.
Great. Thanks very much. I'm going to recommend a site that I just came across recently called Invincible Cities. And it's a site that's hosted at Rutgers that was produced by a really talented photographer named Camillo Jose Vergara and curated by Howard Gillette, who does the introductions to these. It's got a long URL at the Rutgers Camden campus that I'll post to you from digitalcampus.tv. But effectively what it is Vergara went around Richmond, California, Harlem, New York, and Camden, New Jersey, and took extensive photographs over several decades of the kind of places that just aren't normally photographed in cities. So rather than in New York photographing the Empire State Building, he went and just photographed storefronts in Harlem or parks, small parks that generally aren't visited versus Central Park. And he put this all together. It's put together in a very slickly designed website from Tender Creative, a pretty talented web design firm. And it allows you to go through and really look at sort of block by block, for instance, in the Harlem section, the transformations of certain sites over time. So there's a bunch of photographs where he set up tripods in exactly the same point every 5 years for 25 years. And you can kind of see the kind of rise and fall of urban blight and various things going on in Harlem. It's really fascinating, beautiful photographs, and some interesting kind of social history that Gillette has also put together with it. It is available online for free at invinciblecities.camden.rutgers.edu. But again, since it's long and I know you might not have a pen handy if you're on the treadmill right now, we will link to it from digitalcampus.tv. Well, Jeff and Amanda, I hope we haven't raked you over the coals too badly today.
No, it's fine.
Not at all.
It's great to have you on, and we'll have you back on again as our semi-regulars. We'll have to come up with a name for you. You're part of the team now, the Digital Campus team.
I like guest hosts.
Guest hosts. Okay.
I was going to say irregulars.
But... irregulars. Right. Well, thank you to our irregulars, and thank you very much to our regulars as well, Mills and Tom. Good talking to you. And we'll talk to you all again soon, and thanks for listening in on this edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you